Hello and welcome to the Thinking Poker Podcast. This is episode 2. I'm Andrew Brokus, and with me is Nate Mavis. Say hello, Nate.
Hello, everybody.
Today, we are going to be interviewing the estimable Tommy Angelo, who has been one of the big influences in the way I think about poker, and really the way I think about a lot of stuff outside of poker as well. And I think, Nate, you probably feel the same way, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think both of us probably feel the same way, that having the opportunity to talk with someone like Tommy is a big part of the reason why we did the show. Maybe not even someone like talking to Tommy, maybe specifically having the opportunity to talk with Tommy was the reason we wanted to do this podcast project.
Right, right. If we never did another episode again.
Yeah, time well spent.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll say this again, but big thanks to Tommy for coming on, and you should all stay tuned because he was excellent.
Yeah, I was going to say, big thanks for doing such a great job, too. I mean, it's kind of what you'd expect from Tommy, but just, you know, that he's so unflappable and easy to get along with. And I think we had a touch of technical difficulties at the beginning, making sure we could hear everyone okay, and, you know, figuring out what was the best headset to use and everything. And, you know, he's just so patient with those kinds of things, and, you know, never like, oh, you're wasting my time, or why didn't you get this straightened out before you had me on the line? Like, just, you know, couldn't be easier to get along with. And then it takes the interview so seriously. You can tell he's just doing his best to be interesting. He's not trying to multitask or do anything else at the same time. And you really feel like you've got his full attention, and he's being mindful of what he's doing at that moment, which is, I'm sure, not an accident.
Yeah, very generous, both with his attention and with his time. I don't know whether the interview would be more interesting to somebody who's a longtime fan of Tommy's or somebody who doesn't know anything about him. But first, we're going to talk about strategy.
Yeah, and this week we've got a question that's come in from actually a reader of my blog. I had no way of knowing that this could end up in a podcast because he submitted it as something that he wanted discussed in the mailbag section of the thinkingpoker.net blog. But I think we're going to use it instead for the podcast. So this comes in from a regular reader and commenter named Luisinho. I'm not sure if I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly. I believe he's Portuguese.
Yeah, I would have said Luisinho.
Yeah, I almost corrected myself and said that. Okay, so Luisinho. And he says, I was playing yesterday a few tournaments, and I played really badly. I wasn't able to recognize my bad playing at the moment, and I lost a good amount of money trying to play a lot of tournaments and playing as badly as possible. He says he actually lost about 30% of his bankroll just in one frustrating day. Am I the only one who happens to play so bad in some phases? I was aggressive like crazy. I'm reading Gus Hansen's All Hands Revealed, and I'm sure it has been a huge, for me, negative impact. It's funny because I already had some quite good results on micro to small MTTs, but it felt like I totally screwed my game yesterday. Should I just not play when I read a poker book? I'm even wondering if I should not get some distance from the book while reading it. I feel like I'm enjoying it too much without really seeing what it should add to my poker playing. What was your mental state when you began to understand better the game? Did you have these kinds of patterns?
I think the first thing to notice here is that Luisinho is probably tilting, and you really have to focus on tilt management. If you tilt badly, you will not win at poker over the long term. That said, I have lost 30% of my bankroll before. It's only happened once. It was sort of a perfect storm of badness. I took what I thought was a reasonable shot, and it didn't go well. Then I immediately hit a downswing. So it has happened to me. So I won't say that anybody who's ever lost 30% of their bankroll very quickly should quit the game. But I do think that it's a bad sign. It should be a very rare occurrence. Andrew, has it ever happened to you?
It has not. Although I will say I've been A, pretty conservative with my bankroll, and B, I guess fortunate enough that I've often had a bankroll that was too big for the games that I was playing, meaning that, you know, I could have moved up in stakes, but I didn't feel like I was good enough to beat, you know, a bigger game. So I was playing, you know, the limit on where I play has often been my skill rather than my bankroll, I would say. So, you know, even at bad times, I wasn't really in a position to lose 30% of my bankroll.
Yeah, and I do think that it took a perfect storm. It took there being excellent games at the higher stakes available for me, then getting coolered once and bad beat once immediately, then moving back down to my regular game and getting whooped immediately. So, I mean, that's what it took for me to lose that much of my bankroll that quickly. But it shouldn't be happening often.
Yeah, I mean, it does kind of sound like he was chasing losses when he says, you know, I was trying to play all these tournaments, and it kind of sounds like he was maybe going off a little bit. That's the impression I get from reading that.
Yeah, me too. So, I don't want to attribute any character flaws to Luisinho here, but it is something to think about. And the good news is it's something you can work on, and it'll help you in your non-poker life if you do. I know Master LJ has written about how he improved his discipline just by doing things like making the bed whenever the thought occurred to him to make the bed. Just cultivate the discipline to always drop what you're doing, walk over to the bed, and make it if you think that you ought to make the bed and that it's unmade. And he said he became a much more disciplined poker player and a much more disciplined person that way. So I think it's a mistake that people make, which is to think of tiltiness just as an unchangeable personality characteristic, when in fact there's a lot you can do to both influence the degree to which you tilt in the first place and the degree to which the tilt affects your poker.
Yeah, you know, I didn't deliberately choose this to pair with Tommy Angelo's interview, but after hearing you say that, it actually works quite well, because that's a lot of what Tommy's written about is how to control, I guess, how to limit the amount that you tilt. And, you know, I was actually thinking it might be a good idea for people who weren't real familiar with Tommy to provide a little bit of an introduction, because I think at points we assumed that people knew a little bit about his general deal or the kind of stuff he writes about. And this is actually a good opportunity, because it helps to address part of what Luis is talking about. And it's also a good introduction to Tommy Angelo's writing. You know, one thing that he talks a lot about is people having an A game, a B game, and a C game, right? And the A game is like when you're really playing at your best, how good are you? And the B game, of course, is in the middle. And then the C game is often tilt. It's just, you know, when you're not playing well. And, you know, everyone has all of these gears. And a lot of poker coaching and videos and literature and all that focuses on how to improve your A game, how to play better when you're already playing at your best, or, you know, how to make your best game even better. And a lot of what Tommy Angelo's work focuses on is how to avoid playing your C game, you know, not how to make your C game better, not how to play better when you're tilted, but just how to stop playing. And he asked what I think is a very good question, like, how much money could you save if you had never played your C game your entire life? So that's one thing just to keep in mind, is to recognize when you're what are the signs of tilt for you, so that you can stop before you've lost 30% of your bankroll. You know, when you start to notice yourself getting frustrated or saying like, oh, you know, I'm sure I'm going to get sucked out on again. You know, when you catch yourself thinking things like that, that's the sign that you're slipping into C game mode. And I guess in theory, you have two options. One is to try to pull out of it and, you know, get yourself back into A game mode. And the second option, which is probably the right one for most people, is just to quit when you catch those warning signs, rather than thinking, oh, I'm tilting, now let me just think my way out of it. You know, now that I've recognized I'm tilting, I can just stop tilting. I don't think it really works like that. You know, I think it's more when you recognize it's happening, you have to, you know, stop playing. Don't keep buying into tournaments.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially, it sounds like this happened. I mean, it must have happened online if you're playing a lot of tournaments at once. And especially if you don't have to drive 3 hours back from the casino and there's not a whole lot of cost involved in starting a new session later, you can just play out the tournaments you're in, stop playing, and then go do whatever else in the world you would like to be doing that is not poker.
Yeah, you know, it is a little trickier with tournaments, because I wouldn't advise just like quitting the tournaments you're already playing. I do think, you know, don't register for any more. Don't try to play cash games on the side. And, you know, maybe I don't generally really advise people to do this, but if you really feel like you're in a bad mindset, I mean, if you just have like two tournaments going and you're used to playing more tables than that, and I don't think you should be starting up new poker games. I mean, maybe you should watch something on TV or watch a video, or, you know, do something to distract yourself a little bit from the tilt. I don't think that would be the worst idea in the world.
No, I mean, certainly playing two tables and reading some blogs or watching a movie is a whole lot better than playing two tables tilted, and it's a world better than playing 10 tables tilted.
Yeah, so I mean, that's lesson one from this email is, yeah, and this is actually something that Tommy's going to mention during his interview. He talks about one of his big advantages being quitting better than his opponents, you know, just, you know, leaving when he's not playing his best game anymore. And he says that's one of the reasons he doesn't like to play tournaments, is that he can't just quit whenever he wants. But you do at least have the choice not to buy into more tournaments. And generally, I think, you know, recognizing the signs of tilt and then acting on it, which really means quitting. It doesn't mean, I don't think most people are capable of just telling themselves to stop tilting. I think really, you know, when you recognize that you're tilting, the best thing you can do is stop playing, which is hard because it's often the last thing you want to do. But, you know, the fact that you want so badly to keep playing is actually another sign that you should probably stop.
I think there's a lot to be said about what to do when you might be tilting, but for whatever reason you're playing anyway. But that's a long conversation, probably one to have another time.
Let's talk about the second half of this question, because I think this is interesting too. When you're reading a poker book, how much does that affect you while you're playing? You know, are you like drastically changing your style, or even unconsciously changing your style if you're also, you know, reading some new poker book at the same time?
I think more often than I would like to admit, it unconsciously affects the way I play. Less often, it will immediately point out to me something that I can immediately recognize is wrong with my own game. And in that case, there's no choice about whether to act on it immediately. If I'm doing something that's a mistake and I can easily keep the rest of my basic strategy intact while fixing the mistake, I ought to just fix the mistake. I do think that, I mean, poker books are written by people who want to sell books, and they're published by people who want to sell books. And I don't think that Gus is being dishonest or disingenuous, but I do think that in a lot of poker books, they're selling the idea of, here are some tricks that will make you win when now you lose. And there are a couple problems with that, which is that, first, what causes one person to be successful might not be the tricks they're describing to you. I'm sure Gus does a lot of things right, and the things that he happened to encounter over the one tournament of hands that he wrote about in that book. Every Hand Revealed is the book that we're talking about here. If you're not familiar with the book, Gus, I believe, won a tournament or got second place in a tournament. And then he wrote...
Yeah, I think it was the Aussie Millions that he won.
Yeah, and then he wrote about Every Hand. I mean, it's interesting. A lot of people, well-respected people, have said really good things about the book. I'm embarrassed to note that I've never read it. But, you know, this is a pretty small sample of hands. And Gus only ran into so many situations. And the things he did worked. But that doesn't mean that if you did all the same things, they would work for you too. You know, Gus has a whole strategy and a whole image that you don't have, probably. So that's a long way of saying that if you're learning something that could be classified as a trick, or even one street of play, some small fragment of a strategy, you really ought to take some critical distance and reflect on it. And if it's a trick that's working, you have to figure out why it's working. And I try to sit down, figure out the math behind it, think about what's making it work. Think about the why behind the plays being successful before you can think about incorporating it into your own game.
And I think that's true of strategies as well. You know, not just like, here's a spot where you can checkraise, bluff the river or something, but also, you know, because part of the appeal of that book is that the idea is that you're going to be able to play like Gus Hansen after reading the book. And, you know, Gus is kind of notorious for having a very loose style. You know, he plays a lot of hands. And in the book, you see a lot of examples of him playing hands from out of position where he's like calling a raise out of the blinds. He's getting pretty decent odds, but he has a pretty junky hand. And one of the reasons he's able to make this kind of thing work is that, you know, he's a very, very, very good poker player. And I mean, probably also a very good live player, where he might even be acting on things that he's not fully conscious of, but, you know, he's recognizing things about, you know, the way his opponents put chips into the pot or the way they act. He's indicated, you know, he can pick up that they're strong or weak. And it's not that he's holding that back. I just think maybe he doesn't even fully realize the extent to which that helps to make some of these plays profitable. But, you know, just because he's calling a raise with King 3 offsuit out of the big blind, getting 3.5 to 1, doesn't mean that you're going to be able to show a profit doing the same thing. But I think the appeal of those books, you know, especially when you're not real confident already in your own game, because I would say for me, I don't really have this reaction to reading poker books anymore. Like, I more read them now as a critic. Like, I'm more interested in whether I agree or disagree with the strategy in the book rather than like that I'm trying to, you know, adopt it or copy it. But definitely, like, earlier in my career when I read poker books, I mean, I think a lot of people have this experience with Doyle Brunson's Super System. When you first read that No Limit section, all of a sudden you want to play all these pseudo connectors and start playing all your draws aggressively. And if you're not real confident in your own game already, you can read something and think, oh, that strategy sounds like a fun, I'll try that out for a little while.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think what you said earlier about the important part is to understand the why. You know, I don't think you're ever going to be able to just take a play straight out of a book and say, like, well, you know, this guy talks about raising withdrawals, so now I'm going to start raising withdrawals. It's never as simple as that. So it's really about understanding the reasoning behind why a certain play is effective. And then once you understand that reasoning, that can help to improve your poker thinking overall. You know, maybe that person is taking into consideration a factor that you hadn't thought of before, or he's reached some conclusion that, you know, hadn't occurred to you before. And then, you know, from that, he's able to say, well, you know, based on this information, I think you can make this sort of play in this sort of situation. And when you understand it in that entirety, then it's just another option that you can consider at the table. So that's kind of the difference between mimicking and understanding. You don't want to just do something because you saw it. You want to do something because it makes sense to you. I mean, that's how you know that you've learned it, is when you can explain what is the right situation for it and why.
I once read that there are two different ways that people go about their golf, and one kind of person just drills hard and practices hard, and then the other person is constantly looking for some kind of trick or gimmick that they immediately go out to the golf course and do. I have no idea whether that's true or not, but I think there's a really nice analogy available to poker, where people read something in a book and then they immediately go out to the golf course, in this case, the poker table, and then they just try to do it. They just sort of jam it in with the rest of their strategy and hope that it works and feel like they're learning something when they haven't, when really the path, you have to take the material, understand the material, use it to improve your overall understanding of poker, then apply it to your game, then make the modifications that you need to make.
Yeah, and I don't blame the people for this at all, because I don't think this is really true of Gus's book. I think this is more true of slightly less reputable books that are published. But, you know, there's a lot of books out there that explicitly advertise that that's what they're going to do for you. I mean, they literally, the subtitle is like, top tricks to become a winner at poker, things like that.
Yeah, winning secrets.
Yeah, exactly. These books really, I mean, I think it's at least borderline false advertising to claim that you're just going to like understand a couple of tricks and suddenly you're going to become a winning player. But they definitely are marketed that way. So I don't really fault people for thinking that that's going to happen. I don't think that you're like a fish if you read a book and thought that, because most of the books, even if the authors didn't write them that way, and some of them do, but then, you know, the publishers and the marketing people certainly present them as though they were the only thing you need is just start imitating these tricks and then you'll be a winning player too. So Luis's question here is, should I just not play when I'm reading a poker book, or how do I get distance from it while reading it?
I don't think that you have to stop playing poker every time you're learning about poker. One reason for this is that you should always be learning about poker if you're going to be playing it seriously, and you shouldn't never play poker if you want to play poker. So I think if you're reading it properly, you'll have a certain kind of critical distance that will keep it from infecting your play in any unhelpful ways. What do you think?
I think that's easier said than done. I mean, you can say like, well, have a critical distance. And I think it can be tricky to do that. One thing that I think is important is not to try to do everything at once. So if you're reading a book, I think it makes sense to make a conscious decision that, okay, you know, I'm liking this thing that Gus Hansen is doing where he's check raising a lot of flops, and I would like to start trying to do that. So he's also doing a lot of other things in the book that are interesting. He's three betting hands that I don't ordinarily three bet. He's calling out of position with hands I wouldn't ordinarily call with. He's making some big calls on the river. At some point, I would like to work on all of those things, but I'm only going to work on one at a time. So I'm going to keep playing my regular game when it comes to three betting, keep playing my regular game when it comes to calling out of the blinds. The one thing I'm going to start doing more of is check raising flops. I'm going to look back through at all the hands where Gus check raises flops. I'm going to study those a little bit more. The next couple times that I sit down to play, I'm going to focus on check raising those flops. And I'm going to think about what I'm doing and why. And I'm going to kind of evaluate my results, come up with some way of how you're going to determine whether you think what you did was effective. And then, you know, look at your results after the session, maybe even keep track of some hands where you tried to implement that new thing, see how it worked out for you, go back, look at that material again. Hell, you might even be able to write Gus an email and say, you know, here's a hand I tried. You know, what's the worst? The worst he can do is not respond. But I think there's a fair chance you might even get an answer from the author.
That's the second best thing you can do. The best thing you can do is email podcast at thinkingpoker.net.
That's right.
And ask us, and then we'll talk about it.
Yeah, we'd be eager to talk about those sorts of things as well.
No, I think that's a great answer. I would just add two things. One is a distinction between active and passive reading. This is something I'm a philosophy grad student. That means I teach. I teach students in part, I hope, how to read better. If you're reading and you're just sort of nodding along, you're probably not reading all that well. You want to be taking notes. You want to be thinking in a very clear and explicit way about what you're being told. I think that'll help. Thing two is improve the quality of what you're taking in. I actually think this book is good, right? This is not a book that I think you shouldn't be reading in the first place, but there's a mistaken idea out there that there's no such thing as making a mistake by reading a poker book because you might learn something and it might help you, which is a bit like saying that there's no bad food to eat because some food helps you.
No, you know, I have actually read Gus's book. I think it's one of the few poker books that I've read and not published a review. I'm not sure why I didn't review it. I just think I never really got around to it. Now it's been too long since I read it. But I do remember thinking that it was a good book with the possible danger of people, you know, if you try to imitate him too closely without understanding why the things he's doing work, I do think you could get into some trouble. So I'm not surprised to say that it's causing some problems for somebody.
And this gets into a lot to the last thing I wanted to say about this issue, which is that different kinds of poker advice are differently sensitive to time. And what Gus Hansen was doing to win poker tournaments that he described in a book that got published in 2008 is on one extreme of the time sensitivity scale. It's very time sensitive. And you need to be thinking about, like, if you read something by David Sklansky, a lot of that's going to be more on the pure theory end, which will involve assumptions that you should be questioning and will be differently useful over time. But that's relatively, that won't, they don't deteriorate as quickly as, say, 2+2 threads that are just, hey, I got 6-bet, should I 7-bet? Those things change a lot. So pay attention to the publication date.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. And, you know, the one other thing you can do when you talk about active reading, I think it would be helpful if you tried to disagree with the things that you read. And that's the best way to read critically, is to look for holes in the author's reasoning, look for problems with the things that they're saying. And if you don't come up with any, it doesn't necessarily mean that the author is right, but it should give you a better understanding of what's going on. And it may help you to determine what is and is not worth adding into your game. And this becomes more useful the more poker books that you read, because ideally, I think if you're only reading good books, you know, books that are by well-respected authors, that there's reason to think that they contain a lot of good information, then you can look for places maybe where the books seem to contradict each other. Where, you know, one person says 3-bet with a certain hand, another person says it's a good calling hand. And then you can really start to compare those things to each other and make decisions about what's actually the right play. What you'll most likely find is that those people aren't talking about exactly the same situations. Maybe it's a different type of opponent. Maybe it's different stack sizes. Positions are different. You know, there's a lot of factors at play. But it's a lot of times things that look like contradictions won't actually be contradictions when you fully understand what both authors are saying. But if there really is a contradiction, then that's a great opportunity to learn, because now you can try to decide which author's argument makes more sense, which one of these actually represents the way that I want to play this hand going forwards.
If a book is really exciting and new to you, it's probably in part suggesting things that you don't do already. Well, why don't you do those things already? Like, your own game embodies some kind of disagreement with what is being suggested to you by the book. So make that disagreement explicit and then evaluate it as best you can.
Yeah, so you can ask yourself, you know, why am I not calling with these hands out of position that Gus calls with? And then, you know, figure out whether the reasoning behind your own play makes sense. You know, you already have a strategy, whether or not you've thought about it. You have ways that you play. You have decisions that you make routinely. And I think it's very good to make those explicit and to say, why do I do the things that I do? Does it make sense? And books that cause you to question the things that you do are good. Books that cause you to just wholesale replace the things that you do, well, it's not the book's fault probably, but if you're reading with the purpose of questioning the things you already do, I think that's valuable. If you're reading looking to just wholesale replace what you already do, I think you're not really going to find what you're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, oh, right, it's really hard to be out of position on the turn with a marginal hand. That's why I don't check raise a lot of flops after calling with King 3 offsuit out of the blind, you know. So thanks again to Luisinho for an excellent question.
Yeah, and I hope we were helpful rather than than cruelty.
Yeah, I hope so too. And I hope he's repairing his bankroll and learning rapidly. And I hope he keeps on emailing us. Tommy Angelo is one of the big names in poker thinking. Longtime forum posters remember his contributions to limit hold'em strategy back in the boom era,
and just about any serious player knows at least some of his work on poker psychology and life management, much of which is preserved at his website, TommyAngelo.com. He has two books, A Rubber Band Story, which is a collection of dozens of his stories and articles, and The Elements of Poker, a comprehensive book about poker psychology that, in my view, is the definitive book on the subject. These days you might find him coaching poker, writing, making music, and even appearing on this podcast. Thanks for coming on the show, Tommy.
My pleasure, guys.
Yeah, thank you, Tommy.
I'm going to close my email client.
It was sort of fitting, actually. I don't know.
I like that.
Yeah, even without being asked, Tommy brought his own intro music. Well, I'm curious, Tommy, I don't even know if you really consider yourself a professional poker player, because I guess it seems like you do a lot of things that you derive income from a lot of places besides poker playing, right? You're a poker coach, you're a writer, you're a video producer. Is it like a conscious goal of yours to maintain that kind of portfolio, or do you think of yourself as a poker player who just does the rest of that stuff on the side?
Actually, I don't think of myself as a professional poker player anymore. I actually, in the book I'm working on now, I have a section there where I talk about recreationalism. Mm-hmm. And what happened was I was a professional for 17 straight years. It's where I got almost all my income from poker. And then as I got into coaching around 2004, I was making some money. Then it became more and more, gradually became a bigger percentage of my overall income. Until then I stopped coaching and playing altogether in 2006 to write Elements of Poker. So that was for a year and a half I didn't play at all.
All right, so you were just straight writing while you were working on Elements of Poker.
Exactly. I knew that I needed to do that because I had attempted large projects in the past, and they always get derailed because I hit some kind of poker funk. So it was kind of funny how it was like I'm writing a book about, in part, poker funk. And I knew I had to stay away from poker completely, or I'd risk a funk, and then I wouldn't write the book. So I managed to do that. It was like 20 months altogether I went without playing a hand.
Wow. And
so then when I came back and I started playing and coaching again, I was still largely of the professional mindset when I was playing, and I was did a lot of my playing with clients and this and that. But gradually some leaks started coming into my game, and then I did a big analysis of it, and I realized that because I didn't need – to make money playing anymore, because by this time I was charging a lot for my coaching, it affected how I played in some ways you might expect. And so I did a little, some experiments and analysis of my own mindset as it changed. And then I had one particular session where I was just really fed up with myself because I was playing in this slightly gambly, leaky kind of way. Playing some pots I just simply would never even think about getting involved in as a professional on the grind. And I was like really fed up with myself. I was like, you know what, that's it, I'm done. And so it was around 2009 or so, I made a conscious decision to get back to where anytime I play, I'm going to be playing like a professional. Even if I'm only playing about 40 hours a year, which is about what I've averaged over the last 3 years.
Oh, wow.
So I'm not playing that much, but when I play, I'm loving it. I do most of my playing at the World Series.
So you're not a professional player, but you try to play professionally when you play.
Yeah, exactly. And that's about it. I learned a lot through that whole ordeal about – and then it's helped me with the coaching too. It's just about getting in the right mindset and catching the leaks and seeing where the problems are and plugging them up and getting back in the ring.
So what would you describe as your profession now, or what you do for a living? Are you mostly writing these days?
Yeah. If somebody asks me, what do you do for a living? I say writer.
Okay.
It's kind of funny how they came to be. I had this really short little thing on my website called The Hobbyist. So what happened was I was, as a kid, I played music. I was really into that. That was my hobby. And so as it turns out, I became a professional musician. And then during my years as a professional musician, poker was my main passion, my main hobby. And then I became a professional poker player. And during the bulk of my poker career, writing was my hobby. And now I'm a professional writer. And so I told all this to my wife, and I said, I think we should be really careful how we pick my next hobby.
Because you're also picking your next career.
Right. And she said, I think you ought to do music again because I wasn't there the first time. And I'm like, oh. But yeah, I'm just full blown into writing, not just the act of writing, but I'm a real student of writing. You know, I just, you know, just into it. That's where my frontier of expansion is right now.
Well, let's talk about that. What does it mean to be a student of writing? What are you doing to improve your writing?
Well, I read books about writing. I just read a book called How to Write a Sentence by a guy who's a great sentence writer. And it's about analysis. And when I read books, like I just read them in a different way. It reminds me of how I used to listen to music when I was... Hey, honey, I'm right in the middle of an interview. We were just talking about you. Okay, bye. Well, I wonder who's going to be next. Just the analysis I do of writing is all different now. You know, like when I was playing music for a living, if I went to see a concert, I would hear the music, but I was also looking at the lighting and the, you know, the amplifiers and all the details, you know. And it's kind of like that with writing now. I'm breaking it down. Just put a lot of effort into refining my process all the time so that it stays fun and fresh. And, you know, so on a day that I don't feel creative or like doing anything interesting, I always got grunt work I can do to keep the project moving forward. And then, you know, other days, everything's magical and beautiful and the words are just blowing out. And there's just a lot to it.
So in my experience, writing has funks that poker funks simply cannot compare to. Just overcoming the blank page and sitting down and writing can be a very difficult thing to do. How do you do that? When you sit down and you ought to write and you know you ought to be writing, I think a lot of writers have trouble getting from, you know, 0 words to 100 words or something. Like, how do you go about doing that? How do you get yourself in the right frame of mind and actually get yourself writing?
Well, I'm happy to say I just simply don't suffer from that problem. But the reason is that I've already sorted out a lot of my hang-ups and problems and mental issues independently. And so I'm just less likely to have any kind of mental hang-ups because I'm kind of trained at observing what's going on in there and just really familiar with it. And also... my prime objective as a writer is to enjoy the act of writing. You know, that's really it. And so if I'm having, you know, periods where I'm not enjoying it or whatever, I don't look to fix that problem by forcing myself to go write. I look at the lack of enjoyment as the problem itself, which is a whole nother meta level of what I'm doing. And as a result of all that, and because I've already established, you know, some pretty good disciplines, and also because I get to choose what I'm working on and I don't have any deadlines, you know. So all of the problems that many writers run into, you know, like let's say you're just an article writer for a sports magazine, you know, and you've got an article. It has to be due tomorrow and you feel like total shit. That's a problem, right? Well, I've arranged my career so that I'm never in that situation, you know. So it isn't that I've found some magic sort of manage my career so that I'm not in those situations. And like I touched on before, if I just don't feel like writing, and writing for me is like 20% of it is generating new content, like what you were describing, sitting down and typing. You know, most of it is revising and thinking and just.
Absolutely.
Working. And so there's always lots of work I can be doing when I don't feel good or creative. Like, you know, there's always sections of my file of the book that is just like miscellaneous notes that I've collected. Like gunk, and I can go in there and sort those out, you know, mindlessly kind of thing. There's always some sort of work to do for the days I just don't feel very good.
Well, and you're also all your books are self-published, right?
Right.
So I mean, you also have work to do on that front, right? Like you're doing a lot of the things that a publisher would usually do for you.
Oh yeah. In fact, that's the area where I'm more likely to have to, you know, kick myself in the ass to get
right.
than the actual writing of the content itself. And there are definitely times when it almost feels like work. But then I just remind myself how lucky I am to even be able to, you know, make any money at all self-publishing. And then it's like, you know, it's hard to feel bad for very long.
how, How did you make that choice? I mean, you've been a fairly prominent person in poker for a while. Your work is good. I imagine you could have hooked on with some or the other publisher. What made you decide to self-publish?
Well, I guess two forms of greed. One is it isn't that easy to get picked up by a publisher in such a way that they're going to commit the resources it takes to make real money. Okay. Because when you're the writer, let's say the book's selling for 30, and let's say I make a good deal with a publisher and I'm getting $3 a copy. You know, when you crunch the numbers of how many copies need to be sold to, say, pay me a normal working man's wage for the year and a half it takes to produce the book, the chances are low of that happening for a niche book in the poker world. You know, for writing fiction, you have to go with a major publisher if you're going to make any money. That's just the way it is. But for writing an industry book, a trade book, I think they call it, the self-publishing model works really well because it's possible to hit your target because of the internet, you know, very directly. And then the amount I make per book is, you know, if somebody buys it at my site, I get 100% of the money. You know, if somebody buys it at Amazon, I get about half or a little, you know, approximately half of the selling price because I'm the publisher. You know, there's a big difference between $3 a book and $15 a book for my Amazon sales. So there's that form of greed where I really thought I would make more money when I weighed it all out. And then the other part, which is really the main reason, is I needed and wanted to have control over every single word all the time. That was really the main thing. You know, a big part of what I'm doing is trying to share some things, you know, that I've been lucky enough to come to understand. And the way I am with language and this and that, I just needed to not be anybody. I needed to have final say over everything, or else I really wouldn't even be interested in doing it.
And this ties into what you were saying about creating a situation where you're not answerable to deadlines, or you don't have those kinds of pressures on you, and you can really enjoy the writing process.
That's actually a huge – you're right. Right. I mean, I can give you an example. It's really funny from my – I think it was like my second article ever, Poker Digest. It was like 1999 or 2000. Okay. So this is an example of why of one little event that happened that made me realize years later I need to self-publish. Okay. So this will just take a second. So I'm writing this article about this player who, Andre, is super, super loose. He's an actual character who plays around here. Back then, he was like the game in the big no limit game. At Lucky Chances, you know, he was like doing the main donators, or not even a donator, action player. Okay, so I described him in this paragraph, this really well knit paragraph I put together to describe him, and the last sentence, which is the most important sentence, said, "Andre has never played in a loose game." Oh, no, I'm sorry. Andre has never played in a tight game.
Right.
Okay, and the whole point was, if he's in the game, it can't be a tight game.
Right.
It was a joke, right? That was the whole paragraph led up to that joke. And the editor changed it to, "Andre has never played a tight game."
That's
like, oh. I mean, you know, and now this was back when I was way more attached to my work than I am now. You know, I was brand new. I mean, now if something happens like that, or I get misquoted or whatever, it just doesn't matter, right? But back then, you know, the kind of work I would put into that to make it just right and then have the whole thing just deflated and I had no control over it whatsoever, I was just like, okay, that's a pain I want to avoid.
So poker or writing, you're all about avoiding pain.
Oh, yeah.
So I was looking to switch gears, but that actually gives me an opening. A lot of people claim not to fear death. I believe that you actually don't fear death. What's that like?
Have you been reading the book that I'm writing? The book I'm writing right now called Painless Poker has a bunch, I don't know how much of this is going to end up in the book, but a lot of material about end of life stuff and death stuff and relating it to poker. Defining what fear of death is a little tricky because there's different types of fears. It's like there's multiple fears that come with it. You know, like, for example, the fear of not having had the final conversations that you want to have with certain people to make things right. Right. Or the fear of, you know, any kind of bucket list stuff not getting done. Right. And then there's just the, you know, just the basic fear of dying, of the fear of getting really, really sick and being alone and, you know, being in a hospital bed. I mean, even if we don't think about these things directly, they're always kind of running around in there. And then there's also that our moods change. So I can say that, yeah, there are times when I'm in a certain mindset, when I am as unfearful of death as I really could imagine being, let's say, at this point, but it's not sustainable. It doesn't mean I'm going to be afraid of death every single second of my life. If somebody comes up and points a gun at my head, you know, I'm probably going to be afraid, but not necessarily. The crazy part is I can say not necessarily, because there are times when I'm in a completely non-resistant mindset where, and I, because I do rehearse this kind of thing, thinking about death and growing old and dying and moments of truth and all that, you know, I practice this on a daily basis within my meditations, almost like somebody might practice piano. And so if you practice something over and over and over and you've got decent coaching, you know, you're going to get better at it. So yeah, I have gotten better at being less fearful of death and all the things related to it. I'm way less afraid of other people dying. That is for sure. I really don't think I'm going to suffer much over other people dying.
So you describe not fearing death as a result of other things you do, your meditation, your worldview, things like that. I guess I'm wondering if that has sort of, if you think that not fearing death itself has further effects on your life. So like, me, I go to the doctor, I get my physical, I sort of wonder if something's killing me and I don't know about it. I imagine that if I didn't fear death, going to the doctor would be like a different experience. Would you say that not fearing death has a big effect on your life day to day, over and above all the things that you did to put yourself in the position where you don't fear death anymore, or not?
I think what it is the act of becoming less fearful of death, you know, on an ongoing basis, a little bit ongoing, is just one of the things that happens as a result of my meditation. It isn't any different than any of the other things. So I'm also gradually, I'm less likely to get angry, you know, so it's just all part of the package of improvements that come. Now, if you were to say like, why, you know, why would somebody want to work at fearing death less? The reason is to increase happiness and to reduce unhappiness. Those are the reasons. Okay, then you have to look at, okay, how does working on death fear reduction improve things? Well, if you're looking for a straight cause and effect, what it does is it trains the letting go muscle or the non-resistance muscle, so that when something's happening that's good, instead of thinking, oh, I hope this lasts forever, or, oh, it's going to be a shame when that's gone. Not necessarily when I die. It might be gone because I'm going to walk down the street. This applies to every single little thing that we sort of attach to. Instead of fearing that it's going to end, the way, you know, we fear our life is going to end, we fear that our body's going to be ugly someday, then when that fear is not there in that moment, it opens up space for us to just appreciate what's going on at that moment. So that was a very long way to get to the connection, which is anytime we're not afraid of losing what's right in front of us, whether it's our lives or anything else, then at that instant, we are able to just exist with it completely and appreciate it. And so during any moment when I'm not afraid of dying, I can be really, really pleased with being alive, with just the act of being alive.
How does the people in your life feel about these sorts of things? Like, I'm wondering how your wife, for instance, feels when you say, like, I'm not too concerned about losing the people I love or like losing people close to me. Does that ever cause like friction for either with her or with other people in your life?
I only talk to this with people who are interviewing me.
Well, I'm a little offended that you don't seem to care if I just dropped over dead right now.
I would care about the people who are mourning over you, but I wouldn't give a rat's ass about you.
But really, I mean, I kind of wonder, like, if kind of the same way that some people don't like an eternal optimist, right? They're just sort of like, oh, that guy, you know, what's he always in such a good mood about? He's annoying to have around. I mean, is it the kind of thing where, like, if you're in a situation that other people are finding frustrating, and maybe you're stuck in an elevator with other people, everyone else in the elevator is upset. When are we going to get this thing moving? It's hot in here. And you're like, well, I guess I'm in an elevator right now. I mean, I feel like that would cause some friction with all those other people. And they're like, oh, why is this guy not experiencing this frustration with us? And I mean, have you encountered that kind of problem?
Oh, yeah. I go through that all the time. So an analysis of that situation would go like this. Okay. If I'm in complete control of myself and I'm observing everything and my top objective is to reduce the suffering of the system, and I'm part of that system in the elevator, then the first act always is to look at my own anxiety and see what I can do about that, first and foremost. Okay, so the first cause of my anxiety might be the fact that we're stuck in an elevator and the temperature's rising. That's easy. I can get it, like you said, I can handle no problem. Okay, now let's say that for whatever reason, me being calm is creating tension between me and other people. Well, there's only two things I can do here. I can either put into practice things that might calm down the entire system, or I can act like I'm upset. Now, I've done both of those. You know, there are times when it's been right, is according to my analysis at the time, or unconscious analysis, to just play along and go along. And it's like, oh yeah, this really sucks that we're, you know, gonna die in here or whatever. No. Bad beat. There are times when that's really, when I feel like that's the right play. It's just simpler. It's just simpler to go along with everything rather than to, you know, make a scene by being, you know, some weirdo calm person. So it really just depends. But there are times when I'm gonna be calm because that's the best thing. And if it creates tension, then all I can do there is to try to observe the other people's anxiety, whatever it is they're feeling, and you know, just relate to them and feel generous.
So can I ask a poker question?
Sure.
So years ago, you posted something that really stuck with me, among the many things you've written that have stuck with me. There was some thread about a limit hold'em hand, and the hero had some kind of medium strength hand, and he bet the flop, and he got raised, and there was this thread, and the question was, what do you do now? And, you know, there's post, and then you come on and you say, well, I would call, and then I would start playing the river. And I remember being really confused by that at the time, but it stuck with me, and about, you know, I think about it maybe once every 20 hours I play live now, which is kind of a lot if you think about it. And I have some conjectures about what you meant and what kind of situation you were talking about. But I just want to ask, what does that mean? And why would you start playing the river on the flop?
Oh, on the flop. Oh, I remember that. Oh, okay, I remember. I remember specifically what this was about. This was a very specific thing, I'm pretty sure. It was limit hold'em. Did you say that?
Yeah, it was limit hold'em, and I think the hero bet, and he got raised, and you said, I would call and start playing the river.
Right. I can tell you exactly what I meant there. There was a period where I was experimenting with – I was playing 8160 at Bay 101 regularly, and I was experimenting with a really passive way of playing big aces out of the big blind. So and I posted a lot of these hands. And so example would be, I got ace king in the big blind, a guy raises, it doesn't even matter if it was a guy on the button who raises 80% of the time, okay? Small blind folds, and the way I was playing it was, and this is against tough players, I was doing this, and what I felt I was doing was de-escalating the war and concentrating, by keeping the pot small and then concentrating the main decision of the pot to be on the river, I felt like I was putting myself in a position to make really good plays often that were also highly profitable, because it would be a $160 decision on the river into, say, a $400 pot, you know, rather than a $160 decision on the river and an $800 pot or whatever. So this is what I do. Ace king. Check, fold around the button. He raises, small blind folds. I would call. I would plan on check calling the flop no matter what. Check calling the turn no matter what. And then checking the river. And then deciding what to do if he bet. Okay. That was the default line. Now, there were other variations along the way, but that was the default line. And it takes a little while to think about what the betting situations this created, because it wasn't just the strategy itself. It was the way I would do it. And because I knew what I was going to be doing, my tempo, I could adjust it and do it really fast or slow or whatever. But let's say I decided to do it fast. So I check the flop. The guy bets. It's like automatic. I just call. Now I got ace king. Doesn't matter what the board is. It could be ace, ace, deuce, or it could be four, five, six of clubs. He bets, I call. Turn comes. I check. He bets, I call. And like against most players, they're like, that freezes them up at that moment. That's the key moment where I would get my read, where I would really start to get a read, because the flop bet was like automatic. So at that moment when I called a turn was where the reading would begin. And then when the river came, if I check and he bets, now I got to let's assume I have ace high. Let's say I have nothing. Now I got to figure out if I'm going to call. What I meant in that post was, because so much of the hand was scripted in advance, I was able to start playing the river literally at the flop. In other words, all I'm doing is anticipating check bet on the river. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? Is he have it or not? And that's what that meant.
Well, thanks. Thanks. It's interesting because I have found this one line that you wrote sort of spontaneously injecting itself into my thoughts at certain junctures in no limit games. So this happened like four times to me over the summer when I was out in Las Vegas playing. Is I would raise with ace king or ace queen or a hand like that, flop a strong hand, ace high or king high or whatever, and then bet and get raised. And I thought about, you know, and so, you know, here I am, stacks are pretty deep, not too deep, and I've got top pair, top kicker, and I'm out of position, and the guy who raised me is a little bit wild. And then just this line that you wrote, like, interjected itself into my head, and I thought, aha, I should call and I should start playing the river. Uh-huh. And I found it worked very well, actually. I mean, do you think that's...
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, the line itself could be used in that way as a kind of reminder to do that in any game, right? Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And so when you posted that, it made everybody angry, and all sorts of people thought that you were crazy and terrible and you were making all these huge mistakes. And then you think about it for a while, and to me it almost seems like there's a bigger class of no-limit decisions than limit decisions where that's sort of a good strategy, where that's sort of a good line to take. I mean, mm-hmm. I guess in the 40 hours a year that you play, do you find yourself doing things? Do you find yourself still doing things like that in limit or in no limit or in both or in neither or in stud high low with a declare or whatever?
Well, I haven't been playing anything but no limit, but the same thing, it doesn't necessarily have to be that you're playing the river before the flop. But you can definitely be looking, you know, an extra street ahead, and especially in situations where the guy's range is going to be polarized, you know, to some extent. Is that how you still feel it applies, where you're going to be on the defense of the hand, figuring out if the guy's bluffing or not? Or you're just picturing it? How am I going to play the river in any circumstance?
Yeah, I mean, those are definitely some of the situations. I wouldn't say they're the totally – I wouldn't say – like the completely polarized situations, often I'm going to want to fold the turn in a no-limit pot if I think the other guy's got it.
I was going to say earlier, you said you were planning on how you're playing the river on this hand when you have the top pair, top kicker, and I was like, you got to get past the turn.
Right. I mean, usually it's situations where the guy's wild enough where, barring some new information I pick up, I'm going to get past the turn. He's probably going to bet the turn. Usually, right. And stacks are deep enough where I'm going to have a real decision on the river. but shallow enough where I can get all the money in if I want to, probably, or not miss out too much. You know, if I decide that he's pushing with a worse hand or whatever, that I can get all the money in if I want to. So, yeah, I would say sometimes this comes up in a polarized situation, but more often I've just got a hand that can beat a lot of his value hands. He might be pushing a worse value hand. He might have me nutted. He might just be bluffing. I'm probably going to get past the turn anyway. I can get all the money in if I want to. And there's a sort of perfect storm, and I bet, and I get raised, and I think, okay, I'm probably going to make it to the river. That's going to be where my big decision is.
Yeah.
And everything I do from now till then should be just playing in a very controlled way, playing in a tempo that'll give me the most information to make my river decision, and gathering all the information I can for that decision.
Sounds great.
So does that strike you as nonsense or not?
No, it sounds good. I mean, what's good about it is you're not playing street by street. You're not going to be caught off guard on the river, you know, because you're thinking ahead to it.
What do you think about that, Andrew?
Yeah, I was kind of, well, first, I'm astounded that we're talking actual poker strategy with Tommy Angelo. But for me, it's almost more like I'm not so much thinking about playing the river as I am playing all the hands that I don't have. You know, like my thought in that situation is not just what do I do with top pair, top kicker. It's more what are all the hands I could have right now, and recognizing that, you know, I sometimes want to be re-raising, I sometimes want to be calling, I sometimes want to be folding, and then, you know, how am I going to play all those different hands, and which one does where does ace king fall across that spectrum? Is it better as a raising hand or a calling hand or a folding hand? And for me, you know, playing the river means thinking about where to put different hands in that spectrum. You know, what's my calling range going to be? What's my folding range going to be? What's my re-raising range going to be? Also means thinking about how the board is going to develop, so that by the time we reach the river, am I still going to have hands that are capable of calling a shove? Am I still going to have hands, that I might choose to bluff shove with, or that would be good candidates for that? Basically, am I still going to have all of my options open across like all possible turns and rivers? I feel like all of that is, you know, not just your river decision with this hand, but your decision on every possible river with every possible hand you could hold in this circumstance all kind of converge on and inform that flop decision.
Phew.
Sorry, Tommy, you bring out the mystical side.
I just checked cold.
I mean, that's certainly the sort of complete and responsible way to think about any poker hand, but it seems to me that there, not too infrequently, you get in this spot, your opponent, he raises, and you just know by how he did it that the guns are out, right? He's a heavy rock falling downhill, and you're not going to stop. I mean, he's not going to stop betting. You can get the money in if you want to. Mm-hmm. You're going to make it past the turn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's easy.
Yeah.
I mean, any time we go to a specific like that, we're doing exactly what Andrew said, and we're just, collapsing it down to one case, right?
Yeah.
So, Andrew, do you actually think in that, like that, while the hand's going on?
In familiar situations, especially, yeah. And this actually was the other thing I was thinking about when you were talking about this very specific strategy you had, saying like, I always know what I'm going to do with ace king, calling pre-flop, check call the flop, check call the turn, all that's automatic. So I can just be focusing on the river decision. And I feel like that's kind of the value of actual at the table experience, just like having been in all these situations so many times, is that, you know, people, and I'm not one of these guys, but people who do play 2 or 3 million hands of poker in a year, they are kind of doing the same thing. Like you're kind of shortcutting that, like rather than playing a bunch of hands and just kind of having this ingrained experience of here's how I handle all these different situations without really needing to think about it. You've made a conscious decision. You know, I just know what I'm going to do, but it feels like for those guys, they kind of, they have this huge database that they don't even actively have to think about. That just makes a lot of their decisions automatic so that they can focus on the more complicated ones, or they can bring in, you know, big stuff like what I'm talking about, because they're not as focused on some smaller stuff that's just so automatic for them.
Yeah, and that, and just to clarify, the you know, check call thing with the Ace King, that was that really started out only as an experiment, because at the Bay One game, there were several guys that seemed to have pretty decent results that played like that sometimes, and I was like, well, I'm going to try that, and only because when I started doing it, it was working, you know, because all kinds of crazy shit was happening. I mean, I'd have like King Deuce or something get a free play in the big blind, and check call with a flush draw, and then it would go check, and I win with King High, where I was going to give up. You know, so there were all kinds of other pots I was winning and free cards I was getting and other things I was getting because they were frozen by seeing me play Ace King that way. That's the part you can't write into a 2+2 post, and that's the only reason I kept doing it. I thought it was making me money. I just want to throw that out there. But that was limit hold'em only.
Yeah, that is something I think about a lot, because I often find myself, and I'm sure you're even more in this situation, you know, I'm playing against people who put in a lot more hours than I do when I play. And I know both of you guys actually are in that same situation when you sit down at the table, probably even more so than I am. And the one thing I think about is, what can I do to mitigate that advantage of experience that they have? The fact that they've played 10 times as many hands in the last month as I have. And one of them is just, you know, don't give them those situations that they're as accustomed to. So, I mean, yeah, just, you know, calling with Ace King and showing up with weird hands that they're not used to people having in spots means that their default lines aren't going to be as effective. Exactly. And you do get a lot of people who are playing robotically, either just because they're playing so many tables at once if you're playing online, or because they don't really understand poker, but they've learned it from a good coach or watching good videos, and they've learned to mimic poker without doing what I would consider playing poker. And so, you know, when you do things like bet a quarter of the pot, or, you know, bet three times the pot, and they haven't encountered that situation 1,000 times, you know, I like to think that they're less they're not on familiar footing anymore, and exactly. We have at least an equal chance, and maybe even I'm better equipped to deal with unfamiliar situations than they are, whereas all the familiar situations, they're really better equipped than I am.
I strongly agree with that philosophy of creating situations they're not used to.
Do you play the main event? Do you play big tournaments? I you've written stuff about how the pain equation is out of whack. Is that like an absolute thing? Like, you haven't played a tournament in 10 years, or do you ever? Or
actually, I've been going to the World Series since 87, and I have never played an event.
Wow. Aren't you even a little bit curious? I mean, don't you want to know what it feels like to play the big one?
I used to be. There were times when I thought about, you know, it'd be nice to play him or whatever. But that was, it's been a long, long time. But the reasons I don't play any tournaments. I haven't played any tournaments since 2003. For a couple of years, I played some small ones locally, and I played a gazillion of them online when they first came out with them. But in the old days, I went to the World Series. I just loved going there, going to Vegas, playing the cash games. But I didn't play the events because it was way out of line with my bankroll, which was about $4,000, you know. And I knew I didn't really have a realistic chance. So then, when it got to where, by the time I got to where I had enough bankroll to where I could play them, you know, there's a part in Elements of Poker where I talk about tournaments, and the main two reasons I don't play them are that I feel that my profit comes from three groups of decisions. One is my betting decisions, the other one is picking my opponents, and the other one is playing my A game as much as I can. And in order to do that, I need to be able to quit whenever I feel like shit. And so if I'm playing a tournament, I don't get to quit when I want, and I don't get to pick my opponents. And I was like, you know, why should I go pay all this money to go sit in a chair, you know, for hours and hours on end, where very likely the decisions that I make that are really, really good decisions aren't going to matter because I'm probably going to bust out anyway, when I could at the very same moment be on the other side of the room, you know, playing with a bunch of drunk guys at 2 a.m. It's almost like one day at a time I could re-decide to play cash games. But now the way it is, when I go to the World Series, it's basically a party for me. I meet up with people I only see once a year down there, and I visit with clients, and I play in the cash games, which, you know, gives me perfect flexibility to stop and start and do whatever.
So what are you up to now?
The book I've been working on, for a couple of years, is called Painless Poker. And most of it is set in a fictional setting. And what made me think of this just now is you're talking about the writing. And, you know, one of the reasons I'm reading fiction is for the first time I'm writing fiction, where I have real characters who are going to have an arc and the whole deal. You know, most of my stories are only about 1,000 words long, and so my characters don't get very deep. And so as a writer, this is a big new experience. So it's kind of one of the things I'm reading about is characterization and all that. But a lot of it is I'm just learning as I go. So here's the basic plot is there's this place called the Painless Poker Clinic, which I run, and 7 characters have been beamed there. And each one of them is like a combination of classic poker archetypes. And the way I started at the very, very beginning, the way I started forming these characters was I had this list of about 200 kinds of poker pain and about 200 kinds of regular life pain that I'd just been collecting. I just collect lists of stuff.
You're just collecting pain.
Oh, I'm just collecting pain all over the place. And so I went through and I started like just connecting. Okay, these pains would all make sense if they were in one body. You know, these could be in one person. And just sort of sorting them out a little bit, thinking of like, okay, I want to have 2 young guys, you know, 2 25-year-old professional types, one of them a full-time online grinder, the other one more of a live guy, and then I got a crazy Asian. But he's like 50 years old, plays at Commerce, you know, runs a business, rich, plays terrible, but he could play great, and he knows – everybody thinks he's an idiot, but he's actually really smart.
I know a guy like that.
Exactly. We all do. I got one is a woman named Babs, who she's 42, and she's been in poker her whole life. Her dad ran a game in the basement, so she was raised on poker. And he died when she was 19, and he left her $100,000 for her 21st birthday to be her poker bankroll. Atlantic City on her 21st birthday with $100,000 to be a pro, and then, you know, a year or two later she was dealing. So she's been dealing and playing for like 20 years, and she's real crusty and bitter and angry. So anyway, these 7 people are collected at the clinic, and the reason that they get beamed there, the reason they got beamed there was at their moment of greatest pain, at their moment of greatest tilt. And so each of them has a story to tell, like, this is what I was doing when I got beamed to the clinic. And they're proof. This is like the worst stories I can possibly construct. And so those are the characters. And we sit there at the clinic and we go through, you know, a lot of material type stuff that I've been collecting over the years, the last wave of coaching especially. And I'm pretty well along in terms of laying the track for the whole book and the just the flow of it and all that. But there's still a lot of excitement to happen. I don't really know what's going to happen, but it's been a great outlet for, you know, expressing the ideas that I want to get across, because instead of me saying, okay, here I am, some 50-year-old dude, listen to me, 25-year-old man, I'll explain the wisdom of the world. It's like, now I know why writers love to write fiction, because it's not me talking anymore. It's my character, Sonny. It's my character, Paul. So if he calls you an asshole, I'm in
the- You got to sort that out with Paul. That's not my problem.
it's been fun. I'm really excited about it.
You have any other projects you want us to know about?
Well, I intend to put out audiobook versions of my first 2 books concurrently. Like, I think this book project, Painless Poker, is still a couple years away from being done, especially because of the publishing and all that, which requires a lot of work. But in the meantime, I think I'm going to try to release audiobooks of both books, because I've had a lot of requests for that.
Well, I think as much as we could ask you, we've probably taken up enough of your time, but I really just want to thank you again for coming on. It's been fantastic.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad you guys got this thing going.
All right. Fantastic stuff. I found that extremely thought-provoking. I mean, as I mentioned, I've been a huge fan of Tommy's for a long time. So having the opportunity to talk to him about some of the stuff that I've often thought while reading his work was really cool. And then just some of the things he said gave me a lot more to think about, which is, you know, as we were saying in the first section of this show, you know, that's the best, in this case, listening material or reading material is the stuff that provokes your independent thinking. And I think Tommy is always good for getting you thinking. One thing that jumped up to mind for me immediately, you know, he said when he was talking about writing, he said, my prime objective as a writer is to enjoy the act of writing. And, you know, in answer to your question about writer's block, you know, he was saying, I don't see the fact that I'm not writing as the problem. I see the fact that, you know, I'm not enjoying the writing. That's the problem.
Yeah.
I think that's such a good way of thinking about everything. I mean, it's not at all specific to writing. It's certainly very applicable to poker. You know, people are always like, well, how can I stay disciplined and put in all these hours? And you know, that's the way you end up playing your C game, is when you're forcing yourself to play when you don't want to play. If you're really not in the mood to play poker, you know, I think there's one of two problems. Either you're not playing in a way that causes you to enjoy it, like maybe you need to try a different game. You're sick of No Limit, then you know, try playing Pot Limit Omaha, or try playing Heads Up instead of Six Max. There's things that you can do to change it up and keep it interesting if you're just getting bored. And then you know, the other problem is, you know, if you really just don't enjoy poker, like if you hate the game and every time you sit down you're like, I gotta play a few more hands of poker, I'm such a bad mood today, and you see a lot of people like that in the casinos. Yeah. And judging from the online chat boxes, there's a lot of those people online as well. I mean, I think you ought to question whether you should really be dedicating such a large chunk of your life to poker if you really don't enjoy it that much.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important to distinguish Tommy's view from some kind of naive hedonism, like never do anything that you don't want to be doing, sit around and eat candy all day. You know, that, I mean, that's not what he's saying. He's saying that when there's something that you're doing, if you feel bad about doing it, that itself is a problem. You know, he's not saying never talk to your family if talking to your family is stressful. He's saying, you know, if you're feeling stress about playing poker, that itself is a problem. And it either indicates that something's wrong with your frame of mind or something's wrong with your project of playing poker. And of course, we're all going to feel grumpy or less motivated at some times than others. That's just part of being a human, except maybe not for Tommy, but for most of us, it's part of being human. But I do think it's really helpful to see whatever mental blocks you might have as themselves some kind of problem, which is not to say you should feel bad about it. It's just to say that itself is an indication of something that deserves your attention.
Yeah, I like this idea too of enjoying the process itself and not just the goal. So he's not saying, I enjoy being a published author, so I put up with writing, or I enjoy the money that I make from writing, so I put up with the writing. Because especially when it comes to something like writing, but again, this is true of poker as well, the results are really not guaranteed. Plenty of, I would say probably the vast majority of people who write books don't end up becoming published authors and don't end up making money. Same thing, the vast majority of people who want to make money from playing poker don't ever end up making money from playing poker, which is okay as long as you enjoy the process of writing or enjoy the process of playing poker. But I think getting into either thing for the sole purpose of making money or being able to call yourself a professional writer or professional poker player, and I think this is true of a lot of projects. Like we said at the beginning of this episode, you know, if we never did anything else other with this podcast other than interview Tommy Angelo, you know, it would be satisfactory. So right there, you know, we're doing something that we enjoy, and we have bigger, more ambitious goals for it. But, you know, I was the same way when I started playing poker. I was like, well, maybe I can make some money doing this, but either way, I enjoy playing poker. And, you know, if I make money, great. And if I don't, at least I was still doing something that I enjoy. And I think that's the best way to combat any kind of fear of failure, is to know that even if the long term doesn't pan out, that's something that's largely beyond your control. I mean, obviously so in poker. You can be a great poker player and still not make money. That's possible. But you know, even if the long term doesn't pan out, that's beyond your control. But you can at least be doing things that make you happy in the short term as part of your progression towards the longer term goals. And then that way, if the long term doesn't work out, at least you haven't wasted your time because you still enjoyed what you were doing along the way.
A lot of the things that are most worth doing and most exciting and most valuable are really big, long projects. and the final goal is a long way off. You know, I mean, in poker, this manifests itself in a funny way where you get all this immediate feedback. You win and you lose, and you have more money in your pocket and you have less money in your pocket. But you really measure success and failure over the long term. And if you want to make a living at it, you're going to have to be playing thousands and thousands of hours. So if the only time you feel good is at the end, then writing a book is going to be miserable. Playing poker is going to be miserable. And a lot of things in your personal life are probably not going to go so well either. So this focus on the process, I think, is really key.
So yeah, that was one of the really thought-provoking things I pulled out of that talk. Another one, this is, I think, just a good way of thinking about mindfulness in general. This is another thing we didn't really tell you up front about Tommy, and he didn't explicitly say too much about during the interview. But Tommy's, the stuff that he's written about poker is really heavily influenced by Buddhism and by Buddhist thought and philosophy. And there's this idea of mindfulness coming out of that body of thought, which I think is really well embodied by, we were talking about this, the fear of death thing with Tommy. And he says, anytime we're not afraid of losing what's right in front of us, whether it's our lives or anything else, then at that instant, we're able to just exist with it completely and appreciate it. And I think that's a pretty good embodiment of what it means to be mindful. It means that you're thinking about what's going on now in this moment. You're not looking forward to what's going to happen later. So you're not saying, you know, I'm looking forward to finishing this book. You're just focused on what you're writing right now. You're not looking forward to, you know, I want to spend the money that I'm going to make in the next 3 hours at the poker table. You're not looking to how you're going to spend it, or, you know, what you're going to brag about on your blog later or to your friends later about the sick plays that you made. You're just focused, you know, right now in playing the best poker that you can.
Right.
And so that's the same fear of losing. I mean, he's talking about the fear of losing your life in that context, but I think the same fear of losing at the poker table when you have in your mind, oh, I'm up $300, I don't want to jeopardize, you know, I'm just going to play conservatively, then you're no longer playing your best, because you're not playing in the moment just thinking about this hand. You're thinking about having to tell your wife that you lost money, or not being able to pay your rent bill, or all those sorts of things. You know, again, if you're looking forwards or looking back, because that's the other problem that happens in poker, of course, is you're reflecting on some bad thing that happened previously. You're upset about a bad beat. You're upset about a play that you made. And so you're not in the moment. You're not thinking about what's going on now. You're thinking about what happened 20 minutes ago or an hour ago or 3 hours ago. And that means that you're not playing your best. To really be in the moment, especially at a live poker table, you're picking up on a lot of subtle information. Some of this is the stuff I was talking about with regard to Gus Hansen's book. You're picking up on little things your opponents do that maybe you're not even fully conscious of. It. You're not saying to yourself, his eyelid twitched, he's bluffing. But if you're really in the moment and paying attention to everything that's going on, then at least subconsciously, you're picking up on these little shows of strength and weakness of your opponents, and you're going to make slightly better decisions as a result. But that only happens if you're, you know, as Tommy says, existing completely in the moment and not thinking forwards or thinking backwards, but just thinking about what's going on right now. How can I play this hand, these two cards that I'm holding right now, to the best of my ability?
And that's what makes poker such a beautiful game, is that you have all this information coming at you, and you're in a lot of ways, this very rich world of sensory information, of computations that you have to do, and it's hard and it's exciting. And you have to filter and compute and evaluate so many things all the time. And if you, first off, you have no chance of doing it well if you're stuck in the past or stuck in the future or clinging to your sort of temporary image as a $200 winner that day. And second, you're depriving yourself of the beauty and fun of the game if you're not doing that. Thanks again to everyone who's emailed the show, and of course to Tommy Angelo. Over at TommyAngelo.com, you can read his writing and buy his books. He'll even write in a personalized inscription for you if you like. Music this week comes from Ultra Death Men. You can find them at ultradeathmen.bandcamp.com, and you can preview their upcoming album, Muscles. If you like what you hear and can get to Buffalo, New York, they're playing a show there October 16th. We'll leave you with a song they named after a very friendly poker player who also happened to throw 59 consecutive scoreless innings in 1988.
Here's Oral Hershiser.